From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in Berkeley.
Berkeley.
Berkeley, California.
Oh, right north of the LeConte Street.
I'm Ekta. I'm from Walnut Creek.
Coming up, why a statewide proposition on November's ballot has sparked a conversation about infrastructure in schools.
Our research has shown that, you know, over half of school districts in the state are pretty significantly underinvesting annually in their school buildings.
Then a choreographer reminisces on falling in love with house music.
I mean, once you catch the house spirit, it's so infectious. You just want to eat it for breakfast.
And we'll learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound.
This one-day-only appearance brings drag racing royalty to the Bay Area.
Start your engines. It's time for Cross Currents. If you've gotten your ballot in the mail, you may have noticed it roughly resembles a telephone book. In San Francisco, for example, there are 25 local measures to vote on, not to mention 17 statewide propositions. And those include everything from legalizing marijuana to repealing the death penalty. But the thing people probably aren't talking about at dinner parties is school construction bonds. It's not the flashiest of topics, but it's important, and KALW's Hannah Kingsley Ma is here to tell us why.
Yep, that's right. I'm going to tell you a story about school construction bonds. And as I say these words, I can practically feel you, dear listener, reaching for the dial or slowly tuning out. Well, I'm telling you, don't. And the reason is these guys. Those are kindergartners at Park Elementary School in Hayward. Right now, they're wobbling into the lunchroom, greeted by parent volunteers. Park Elementary is a cheerful place. The halls are dotted with murals of tiny green handprints and scribbled on schoolwork. But take a closer look, and you see the building needs an upgrade.
And I'll show you around. You can see some of the doorways, some of the dry rot.
That's Steve Fallon, who manages maintenance, security, and transportation for the whole district.
All asphalt. So if you look around the playground, and we'll patch it as best we can, but it would cost approximately $350,000 to $400,000 per school.
Two dead trees stand right next to picnic tables. And after recent rains, there's a new pest problem. But Park Elementary is one of over 30 schools in the district, and money's tight.
For the whole district, we have one plumber, one electrician, one carpenter. Due to budget cuts, we've lost 21 positions in maintenance over the last 5 years.
On the top of Fallon's to-do list?
We probably need 10 new roofs in the district, and the longer we delay that,
the more expensive the repairs. Californians haven't voted on a school construction bond in 10 years, and state funding's dried up. Proposition 51 is here to try and replenish those coffers with $9 billion worth of bonds. To break down that big sum of money, well, most would be set aside for K-12 schools, building new facilities and modernizing old ones like Park Elementary. Another big chunk would be spent on community colleges, and a smaller portion would go to charter schools and career technical programs. Now, the State Legislative Analyst Office predicts that if Proposition 51 passes, it would cost the state nearly $18 billion with interest. The cost is high, but so is the need.
I mean, our research has shown that, you know, over half of school districts in the state are pretty significantly underinvesting annually in their school buildings.
That's Jeff Vincent, Deputy Director at UC Berkeley's Center for Cities and Schools.
And this really raises concerns about, you know, what are the conditions and qualities of these schools? Are they safe? Are they healthy? Are they educationally appropriate?
His research explores the ways school construction projects can actually exacerbate inequality.
School districts serving more low-income children, they're actually spending more per student out of their operating budget on their facilities than higher income school districts are. And this raised real flags for us.
Because without state funding, local communities have to rely on other methods, namely local bond measures and local developer fees. In a school like Park Elementary, where most kids qualify for free and reduced lunch, they don't have a big pool of money they can tap into when they need to build new doorways. But here is where things get really complicated, says Jeff Vincent. even if Prop 51 were to get passed,
an equitable approach to allocating state funds is not baked into the program.
Schools have to apply, get in line, and show the state they can match whatever funds they receive. Because of this, critics of Proposition 51 say it doesn't go far enough to be equitable.
All four of the last school construction bonds that have passed in the state of California have had very broad support across the aisle and with governors. This new one, Prop 51, doesn't have that.
Governor Jerry Brown's a vocal opponent, in part because a lot of the funding for this proposition comes from construction companies and developers. It's one of the aspects that's making some voters wary. But others argue what's worse than that is no money at all.
If Proposition 51 fails, the inequities across districts are most certain to widen. If Proposition 51 passes, will it go far enough? No, it won't.
If we're being honest here, it's a tough choice to make. We can either deprive schools of much needed money in hopes that desperation sparks reform, or we can sign off on a costly bond that might not go where it really needs to. But come November 8th, it's the decision you and I are both going to have to make. Regardless of the outcome, both sides agree. It's time to have a long, hard look at school maintenance and construction and how much the state should pay for it. Because what's at stake is kids' long-term health and safety. For CrossCurrents, I'm Hannah Kingsley-Ma.
We have lots more election coverage over at our website, including two-minute briefs on all statewide propositions. Go to kalw.org to find out more. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In election season, we focus a lot on politicians as vehicles of change. But with Embodiment Project, choreographer Nicole Clay Moon tries to enact social change through street dance, live song, theater, and spoken word. Nicole is currently a resident choreographer at ODC Theater in San Francisco, and her company, Embodiment Project, is performing next weekend as part of the theater's 40th anniversary celebrations. She sat down with KALW's Jen Chien to talk about using movement to honor and humanize stories often overlooked by mainstream media.
This current piece that you're doing, Seed Language, it was originally made in collaboration with Destiny Arts, the Youth Arts and Empowerment Program in Oakland. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about that work that you guys did together and how this piece came about?
Their company and Embodiment Project are very much aligned in the sense that we're both rooted in social justice and do a lot of racial equity work and are very interdisciplinary. And our main art form is hip hop. So things were really natural. It was like we were already in conversation before we started collaborating.
And can you tell me about the title Seed Language, where that comes from?
Well, initially we were calling it Seed Language, A New Identity. It was part of a poem that I wrote a long time ago where I'm really examining the function of language as being, we can tell a lie, but our bodies are always holding the truth, and what percentage of communication is nonverbal. So Seed Language, I think, is really examining this idea of a movement of a people being a very dangerous thing, that people moving together has tremendous power. And so Seed Language, to me, is about finding the truth that lives in our bodies in the way that that our movement, how we move through the world, is its own language, and seed being kind of like going back to the source, looking for a way to embody this knowledge base to respond to the times right now and to access our humanity.
Your work really comes a lot from street dance, especially house dancing and house music. That's a very particular subculture. How and when did you get into this culture? When did you become a househead?
Well, it was Rennie Harris. It was really getting the opportunity to train with him in 2006.
And for folks who might not have heard of Rennie Harris, can you explain who he is?
Yeah, so Rennie is a choreographer. So I was training with him in Los Angeles, and I remember just having that experience where I think I understood on some heart and gut level that this dance was rooted in survival. I definitely was familiar with the history that, you know, house music and house culture comes from predominantly gay people of color. The music comes from Chicago, and those stories of resiliency and, you know, finding a place to leave it all on the dance floor and to find celebration and human connection and a safe environment in a world where, you know, you're being pushed out and disenfranchised, not seen or invisibilized. I think there was that spirit of reclamation of self. I think I got in a time in my life that I really needed that. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways this dance saved my life.
And you were an adult at the time?
Yeah, so I was
a young adult.
Young adult. Yeah.
And had you had dance training, dance experience before that already?
I had.
But not that kind of dance.
Right. That was I definitely had been doing hip hop. And I also had been doing a lot of modern dance. I always took to improvisation. Just getting free was my thing. So the improvisational component really spoke to me. But the relational, like the culture and being in an environment where, you know, you're like, my education was like basically in the club. I remember like packing my backpack and putting on my hoodie and driving or parking in really like sketchy alleyways. And I like understood, like, this is both my spiritual practice, my prayer, and this is my training, you know. And I remember going to this club in LA called Deep, or it was an event called Deep. And it was a really, you know, because LA has that, like, you know, it was a shared space with, there was that kind of a Hollywood, like people doing coke in the bathroom with like a lot of, what do you call it, Botox, and like, uh-huh. And then dancers like in the corner next to the speaker. It was really bizarre to me, that kind of shared environment, and that in that context, like, was really where I caught the spirit. And like, I mean, once you catch the house spirit, it just, it's so infectious. You just want to eat it for breakfast. And I get to watch people when they start to really get the mechanics of the dance and how organic it is. And I think really there's just a spirit in this dance that's ancient. And I love watching dancers when they start to really get it.
A lot of your work, and especially this current show, Seed Language, is centered around experiences and history of people of color. Mm-hmm. And that this is a dance in a social space where you've found a home. Mm-hmm. So what draws you to making this kind of work, and how do you identify culturally?
Mm-hmm. Culturally, my ethnicity is Sephardic Jew and Native American and French and Russian, and definitely falling under this invention of whiteness and
the white umbrella.
The white umbrella. I think that one of the core inquiries I have as an artist is how to use performance in a way that navigates trauma in the body, historical trauma, making visible these stories that have been invisibilized. And I think that in a lot of ways, my creation of Embodiment Project and my path as an artist has been a result of wanting to heal and honoring and having reverence for the history. And oftentimes, I think in this culture, people will see street dance and they'll be like, I want to be able to do those moves. Those moves are so cool. But and divorcing themselves from the history and not wanting to really acknowledge the pain and the trauma that has informed that movement, you know, the stories of the communities of people. So that's a really important part to our practice together, is to honor those stories of pain and suffering and the stories of the war on Black and brown people in this country, and in a way that also invites us to self-actualize too. So how we relate without projecting onto, oh, I understand what that's like, because I really don't know, but what have I experienced in my own life that allows me to access a deeper empathy?
That was choreographer Nicole Claymoon speaking with Jen Chien. Nicole's company, Embodiment Project, will be performing as part of the 40th anniversary celebration of ODC Theater in San Francisco's Mission District. That's this weekend. For more details, go to kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you this sound.
This one-day only appearance brings drag racing royalty to the Bay Area.
This area is designated for Woodies only, and they come from all over the West Coast.
Think you recognize that? To tell you more, we sent KALW's J.C. Howard to the Alameda County Fairgrounds.
We want to welcome each and every one of you to the Good Guys Rod Custom Association's 30th West Coast Nationals. That's right. 3 decades, the West Coast Nationals. The Good Guys DJ Axel. And
100 or so people are crowded around 3 cars for the Nitro Thunderfest. It occurs at the height of the day here at the West Coast Nationals. There's nothing to see at this event, only to hear. A man walks up to me and, without saying a word, hands me foam earplugs. And then these engines roar. I can feel them rumbling in my chest. Some insiders actually call this the Cackle Fest because of engines that sound like this. These may be the loudest engines at the West Coast Nationals, but engines of all kinds are rumbling all day long. About 75,000 people have descended upon the fairgrounds for the weekend to enjoy music, Boston baked beans, and of course, the 3,000 classic and vintage cars on display. Car enthusiasts are scattered throughout the fairgrounds, flanked by rows and rows of hot rods and muscle cars, all beautifully painted and polished. And some car owners have even accessorized.
Got a 54 Plymouth Belvedere wagon. It's got a Prestolite cigarette holder.
That's Grant Ragsdale. His Dusty Rose station wagon is fully staged with period correct gear, complete with luggage on top, a thermos and picnic gear, and of course, a pack of Camel cigarettes in the dash.
You would have a pack of cigarettes in the holder, and as you're driving, you flip down the holder, it would light it, and then you just start puffing on it.
This looks sort of like an old school Subaru to me, but Ragsdale compares it to a different car.
I mean, this would have been probably the compact model car, the Prius of that era, 54. I'm a pretty big guy, I fit in it, feels comfortable.
Ragsdale's car is displayed with lots of other models, a luxury Rolls Royce, cruisers, pickup trucks, but there's one type of car that has its own section.
This area is designated for Woodies only, and they come from all over the West Coast just to come here and show their cars.
Jerry Gomez is working in the Woody section today. He's actually helping to direct traffic. He explains to me that a Woody is basically a station wagon with wood grain on the side. Gomez tells me that Woody's were a big part of the surfing scene in Southern California back in the 60s. The Beach Boys even wrote an ode to these cars. Gomez has never owned a Woody himself, but he's owned a few other classic cars. He bought his first car in 1954 for only $25. It was a 36 Plymouth Coupe. And that car is long gone by now, but he's been an enthusiast ever since.
And I remember coming to these shows and my wife, I said, look at these old farts. And here I am now years later, now I'm an old fart, and here I am working with these cars.
This one-day-only appearance brings drag racing royalty to the Bay Area. Don't miss your chance to meet this legend and see a couple of his famous floppers on display.
I'm excited to be here and be part of the show.
This is John Force, a drag racing legend.
John Force, Brute Force, they used to call me, and now I'm not the champ, I'm just Ashley's dad.
That's clearly not how the crowd that gathers for autographs and pictures feels about him. In addition to the meet and greet, Force brought some of his own old race cars to show. But really, like other attendees, he seems to just enjoy looking at everyone else's cars.
I snuck around for about 30 minutes getting to see part of it. It's great, it's huge, it's unbelievable.
And you can do more than just look. There are a number of people here to sell their cars.
This is a 1968 Impala 427, which is very rare convertible. This is a 1965 Cornette Hemi. And that's considered a 1968 Dart, Hemi Dart.
Tommy Watts owns a shop in Los Angeles. These are three of the cars that he's worked on. One of them, the 68 Hemi Dart, now has a modified boat engine in it. Because, why not?
The boat flipped, the motor went one way, and the boat went one way, and I got that motor, made it streetable. It used to have 3,500 horsepower, now it has 1,200 horsepower. So it has a lot of history to it.
For some attendees, it's not just about the history of the cars. It's an opportunity to take a trip back through their own personal history.
People come out to buy cars that they couldn't buy back when they was in high school. These are cars that people had when they was in high school or their parents had. So this is the opportunity to come to these type of car shows just to buy them already done.
My high school dream car was a Hummer. But today, on my way out of the West Coast Nationals, I see a new dream car. A beautiful, bright yellow hot rod. Something tells me that's also out of my budget, so for now, I guess my Civic will just have to do. At the Alameda County Fairgrounds, I'm JC Howard for Cross Currents.
Thanks, JC. A lot of you called in and knew this week's mystery sound was about Woody's, but nobody quite knew where we recorded. But don't despair, you'll have another chance to win next week. Are you ready for your sneak listen? Here we go. I know where that was recorded. Do you? Give us a call and tell us all about it. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. I love hearing your voices. Thanks so much for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie King.
Thanks, Julie. And that's it for us today. Our team includes Josiah Luis Alderete, Leela Day, Olivia Henry, Angela Johnston, Greer McVeigh, Ted Muldoon, Lisa Morehouse, James Rowland, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Los Sinsonteles, or the Mockingbirds in Spanish. They'll sing and dance at the center's Day of the Dead event. That's Saturday night starting at 7 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanna Baba.
Eres mula retobada que no sabes de gamarra. Me cansaría de ensillarte si no fueras tan chapada.